The following is a point of view program. Opinions expressed are those of the participants.
One of the things I love about my job, the most amazing things about my job, is that you learn something new every single day. So you might learn it because you were digging into a collection, or you might learn it because a researcher came and asked you a question and they're doing research that you'd never, they're asking a question that you'd never thought to ask.
You're listening to In Other Words. I'm Ann Zaldapetri, and tonight I interview Donna McCray, Head of Archives and Special Collections at the University of Montana Mansfield Library. Tonight, she'll take us through the mind of the archivist and describe how she goes about making the decisions that shape the University of Montana Archives and Special Collections. Stay with us.
I'm sitting here at the University of Montana at the Mansfield Library, and I am back in the deep bowels, so to speak, of the archives. And it's almost like I'm deep in the heart of a pyramid. And I am sitting here with a very patient Donna McCray. And would you introduce yourself?
Sure. So as you said, my name is Donna McCray, and my position title here is Head of Archives and Special Collections for the Mansfield Library.
What do you do in that position?
A little bit of everything, and I love pretty much all of it. So my job as the manager of the department is to oversee all of the little bits and pieces of the activities that happen here, and they include things like identifying collections of unpublished materials like diaries and letters and photographs that I think have research value and say something about Missoula and the area or the state and its events and its people. I get to talk to donors, so people who have these collections, finding out if they'd be willing to give them to the library for access by the public. We do the actual organization work, so putting the materials in an order that makes sense, hopefully, for researchers. We get to help people with their research. That's one of the most fun parts of the job, is really connecting, whether they're genealogists or undergraduate students or a scholar writing their fifth book. You know, we get to connect them with the resources that we have. We do exhibits. We do oral histories. We do programming. It's like there's something new every day, and I love it.
Sounds like a dream job, actually.
It is a dream job.
Yeah. How did you get here? How do you find yourself here at the University of Montana?
I did my undergraduate at the University of Colorado in Boulder, which is where I'm from, Colorado. And at that time, I thought that I wanted to get a PhD in history. Went and talked to one of my professors and found out just how hard it is to get a job in the field of history. So I took several years off. I actually worked in an emergency department as a patient advocate. And what I found through that work is the power of connecting people with information, and decided that I really didn't want to stay in the medical field or become a social worker. What I really wanted to work with sources of information, and especially historical sources. And it turns out that's exactly what archivists do. I didn't even know what an archivist was until that point. I started to do research about how I could match my interests with maybe a way to make some money. And so I went back and got a master's degree in library science with an emphasis in archives administration from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And my husband and I then moved back to Colorado, where I had a job with a public library in Colorado Springs. And when this job came open at the University of Montana, my husband and I had both really wanted to move to Montana. So I applied and they hired me, and it was a very happy day.
What do you study when you get a master's degree in library science?
Oh, great question. So there's a variety of, we study how to find information, how to organize information, how to really work with, I'll call them researchers, but it's the range of people who have a need for a piece of knowledge or a piece of information, and how to really understand the question that they're trying to ask. Often people ask for a specific source, like, can you show me where the dictionary is? But what they really need is so much deeper than that. And oftentimes you don't know how to ask for what you don't know. So part of our job is to really, through the process of inquiry, to help dig into what is the real question? What is the real information need? And then what sources do we have at the library, or are we aware of, that exist elsewhere that help to fill that information need? We study collection development, which is sort of the process, either the art or the science, of identifying materials that would be most useful for the type of research that we focus on, and then how to acquire them, what are the copyright implications, how can we provide access to them. There's a lot that we study about intellectual freedom and freedom of inquiry, the ethics behind doing the work that we do as well.
When you talk about knowing what question is under the actual question, do you look for keywords, or how do you discern that?
It oftentimes is a real give and take. We call it the reference interview, but the real give and take behind sort of digging into what are you trying to answer? You know, not just what piece of statistical information do you think you need, but what's the underlying query? And oftentimes it can be a longer process. So for example, at the archives, we frequently have maybe days worth or weeks worth of back and forth, either by telephone or by email, as we come across something that we think might answer the question and follow up with the patron or customer, and they might say, well, that's close, but what about, you know, do you have anything further about this time period or this place? You know, do you have a map that shows this trail? Then we'll dig in a little bit further to what it is that they're trying to answer.
I can't help but draw the connection between that and what I do as a therapist, because of the expansiveness of it and the not ending up where you start. And I guess I'm thrilled somehow that that happens in respect to a person's overall research, as well as in respect to their attempting to understand self. And I'm so happy that you guys take the time to do that. How much time can you devote to any single requester?
So we do try to set limits. We say that we will do about an hour's worth of research for somebody. The truth is that sometimes it's an easy, like we have an answer to a question and, you know, we can tell you what the mascot's name was, or we can answer something really quickly. We have been known to do a day or two worth of research or more for somebody who doesn't live close by and can't do their own research. But we try, because there's so many things that we need to be doing and other questions to answer. We have a list of graduate students and people in the community who do research for a living. And at some point, when the amount of work is going to take more time than we actually have, we will refer to our list of researchers for hire.
I had no idea that there were people that were researchers for hire.
There are, yeah. So if you're in, let's say you're in Washington, D.C., or you're in England, and you are really interested in a piece of legislation that Senator Mansfield, was involved with, and you don't have time to come, or it's more expensive for you to fly to Missoula, rent a room, and do days or weeks worth of research than it would be for you to pay somebody who's already here on the ground to do research. Having said that, it turns out that archives and special collections are actually good for the economy in some ways, because people do travel to the historical society or to the archives to do their research.
What fascinates me about that question is I'm imagining having a research question I'm wanting answered. It would be hard for me to trust that somebody else could figure out all of the angles that I wanted to take with it.
Right.
So these researchers for hire must be really good and also really intuitive to be able to stay in business and keep doing that. Is that true?
It is true. It's also true that the person who's best going to know their research question and the piece of information that answers that question is the researcher, him or herself. So I think it's always best when somebody can come in person, because they can look through all of the documents, and it might be, any one of us who's done research knows that sometimes your aha moment comes not from the document that you thought you needed, but the document that happened to be in the same folder, or the photograph that happened to be taken just down the street on the same day or something like that. So it's always best, I think, when somebody can come and do their own research, which is one of the reasons why archives around the country and around the world are really pushing to put their content online, to digitize their content, so that the researcher from wherever they are can actually do their own research by looking at the content themselves.
I imagine that that's true, and that the archives in some ways are a map of the thinking of the archivist. at least at some level. And I'm sure that you try to set up cautions around that to make sure that that's not too true, but the archivist has got to be in there somewhere.
It's really interesting that you mention that, because that has been part of a professional debate, and actually a fairly recent professional debate. We used to, as a profession, try to claim neutrality. And the truth of the matter is that we are not neutral. Every selection that we make, every decision we make about what to keep or what not to keep, what keywords to use to describe a collection and what doesn't get described, because when you have a box of, here's an example, the records of the Missoula Mercantile that we have here at the archives, they are indicated as being the Charles McLeod papers because he was the owner president of the Missoula Mercantile. Well, now in the 21st century, we realize that that collection includes content about women and content about children. But when the collection first came in, the archivists really organized it and described it as business records and the records of the man who was the president. So the map, we are not neutral in our selection as archivists, and we are not neutral in our description of the content as archivists, and the profession is becoming more and more aware of the need to be transparent about the decisions that we make as archivists. So hopefully the researcher benefits from that.
So Donna, where did you grow up and what was your family like?
I'm from Colorado. So we kind of lived all over the Front Range, lived for a while in Greeley, for a while in Lakewood. It's my mom and dad and my sister and me. And I can remember, some great memories are my dad worked as a curator at a museum, a mining museum in Idaho Springs.
Did you get to go in there?
Oh,
like
yeah.
After hours?
Yeah. And I think that's what really inspired my love of history is just being able to explore, to learn about the history of the area, to see it represented in this great big physical building that was the mine, and sort of like Night at the Museum, to be there when nobody else was there. You know, I was there when he opened up, or there when he closed, and we'd have a little bit of time there when there were nobody else in the building, and it was just really special.
Do you have some memories of favorite artifacts or favorite items that were there?
Not specific small items. It was the physicality of the entire building, of the fact that the building was so huge and you'd walk up the wooden stairs, everything was wooden, and you could peer down into the great big vats that you know used to have some god-awful chemical in them, and the big stamps that used to crush the ore, and just the enormity of the size and the weight, and thinking about, the museum was really, really quiet, but thinking about how loud it must have been to work there and really how dangerous, and the dust in the air. So yeah, it was not individual pieces of rock or individual pieces of ore or anything like that, but the whole physicality of the place. And I think that might have led to my interest in interpretation, of telling the story of a place, or in this case, in the fact that I work mostly with these two-dimensional materials, of telling the story of the creator and the context of creation, and trying to get that story right to make it accurate and to illustrate it with pictures, which is why I think I love the historic photos so much, reading the articles of the time period. And yeah, so that, and Dad used to take us on road trips, and we had to stop at every single historical marker and every single historic site. And now I do that when my husband and I go on trips, we stop at every historical marker, and it's fun.
Oh my God, I do that too.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm a signed reader. Going to the museum with me is the worst.
Yeah,
I've been
right.
told.
It takes me hours. Yeah. Right, I'm going to read every single thing that's there.
And so you're married?
I am married, yeah.
How long?
I've been married almost 23 years now.
What's your husband do?
He is a nurse at St. Pat's, and when I met him, he was a paramedic.
Wow.
Yeah.
Exciting.
And he's done a couple other things that have been really exciting in that time too. In fact, when we first moved to Montana, he worked on a ranch for a number of years. So I grew up in the suburbs. It was completely different from the life that I had grown up with. And It was great.
He must be as interested in history as you.
I don't know that he's as interested in history. He is just fascinated in learning all kinds of things. He's very mechanically inclined, takes things apart mentally and physically. And I think the inquiry, the process of inquiry and being curious about your place, for me, it's in the realm of history. And for him, it's in the realm of the physical, or especially for nursing, in the realm of what makes people healthy or unhealthy, and what can you do to make people feel better, and how does the chemistry work? So it's a lot of what he's doing now is thinking about people, not as machines, but people in terms of how can you make them better.
How about TV?
I don't watch a lot of TV.
I want you to say your favorite show is American Pickers.
I love American. Yeah, right, right. And too. Pawn Stars.
That's all I watch. I love those shows so much.
Yeah. And Antiques Roadshow. Yeah. So those, right, absolutely. Those are the shows that I love. And I love watching the A&E shows, the documentary histories and the, you know, the channel, biography channel, and watching those kinds of, yeah, absolutely.
Have you ever seen the King Tut exhibit?
So when I was living in Colorado, they brought, I don't know if it was King Tut, it might have been Ramses, same kind of content, through to Denver, and it was absolutely amazing. And then I also had an opportunity, I went to Semester at Sea when I was a junior in college, and had an opportunity to actually go to Egypt and tour the museum there, and it was, yeah, just amazing.
I got to see that when I was in the eighth grade, and for 10 years decided I was going to be an Egyptologist.
Oh, yeah.
Based on that.
I just like the gold. For some reason, yeah. I was really attracted. And when I went back to the Museum of the American Indian, for some reason, I was really attracted to the gold display.
Oh my gosh, me too. And the way that they had it set up, the lighting made the gold even that much more sparkly and magnificent. Yeah. And I could have stayed in there probably for the rest of my life.
Yeah, I would love to go back. And I could have spent, right, I think I was there when it opened, and I might have still been there when it closed, and opening all the drawers. And oh God, I'd love to go back. Yeah.
Does the archive feel like a museum in some ways?
I think it does in some ways, just because of the way that all of our content is not, you can't just walk in and pull it off the shelf and touch it yourself. There is that intermediary. You know, it's not necessarily behind glass, but we deliver it to you in a box, and you have to use it in our reading room. So in that sense, I think it's like a museum where there is that intermediary. But I also think that it's not like a museum in the sense that it's mostly two-dimensional materials, the paper and the photographs. And when I think of museum, I think of three-dimensional materials. I also think that museums do a really amazing job on providing contextual information, the interpretation of content, which we do less of. We often leave the interpretation to the researcher or end user.
I think the illusion, as you say, of objectivity is always present in people attempting to do good science, or anybody that attempts to shape information from other people or for other people, both, I guess. Where do you see it going? And I'm imagining a stronger emphasis on diversity, so that those in the archivist profession, so that those decisions are not always made by the same category of people, if that makes sense. Or
right. There's definitely a trend, not a trend, a real conscious effort on the part of the profession as a whole to recruit diverse archivists. And that's not just ethnically diverse. It's diverse across the board, in perspective and age and experience and areas of expertise, as well as culture and ethnicity, so that the collections that we seek out, maybe we have broader perspective about what we should be collecting, more connection to community, more awareness of what's happening within community, and more ability to acquire materials that will be of interest to researchers who don't look like us or think like us in the future, so that the archives is as holistic as possible. The challenge is that we have limited resources, we have limited space, limited reach, and most of us do have what we call a collecting scope, so an area of emphasis that we try to maintain because we can't collect everything. For example, I don't collect the history of Kentucky, and in fact, I don't even collect the history of Eastern Montana except as it exists in the papers of politicians like Mike Mansfield. So we can only do so much with the resources and the time and the space that we have.
What is your scope of collecting just personally? What are you most interested in?
So this archives focuses on collecting the history of the University of Montana, of course, of Missoula, its people and its events and its activities, the Five Valleys region more broadly, and then Western Montana more broadly than that. We collect with an emphasis right now in the environmental history of the area, grassroots conservation movements. We collect the political history of Montana, so the papers of politicians who represented either Western Montana or the entire state of Montana at the national level. And then we also do collect some state politicians' papers and activities. I have a real interest in trying to collect more diverse materials, and especially in the LGBTQI community. But it's a time and effort, determining where those materials exist, making connections with that community, letting them know what the archives does and why we would be interested in acquiring those materials, because it has been to this point an actual physical acquisition, bringing content in now with more and more content available online or on the web or as YouTube video or podcasts. There may be an opportunity for the university and the archives to partner with community entities to make sure that their content that they're creating and providing access to exists not just now over the next 5 years, but still exists 100 years from now and is easily accessible to researchers.
Why the LGBTQI community?
I think that has been an important aspect of what Missoula is. It is more welcoming, I believe, than other parts of the state. There are more people who openly identify as being gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender in Missoula because it has been a place where there's community support. So I find that the fact that this archives does not have a lot of collections right now that document the movement, the what was happening in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and up to the present day in Missoula, how people were coming together, how they were supporting each other, is a deficit in our archives. And it's a deficit that I'd like to repair. But I do think that we're certainly strong in other areas, like the collections that document grassroots conservation and wilderness movements. And politicians certainly is an area of strength for us. So the LGBTQI community is just an area that I think people are interested in now, will continue to be interested in, and it would be nice to have those materials publicly accessible and preserved over the long term.
Let's say that someone has given you I don't know, 25 box collection of something that is really important and really vital to have. Will you go through the process of what happens?
I'll tell you about a collection that I picked up a couple years ago, the papers of Doris Milner, who was a wilderness advocate, lived in Hamilton. I can't remember the exact year that she passed away, but she's been dead for a while now. And her family contacted me happily through a third party who had been here and had used other collections that in similar scope and suggested that the family might want to place her papers with us, which I was thrilled about. And I absolutely wanted them. So I went down, I talked to them. Some of them were in the house, some of them were in a storage unit. I went down with a colleague of mine. We spent a day taking the materials out of the storage unit and out of the home and putting them in our vehicle and bringing them back to the university. They hadn't been looked at in quite a while. There was some organization to them, but some of them were very unorganized. So what we do once we bring them back here, if they need to be physically cleaned, in this case, some dusting needed to be done, we do that first so that the materials are, you know, not unhappy. the person working with them is happy to work with them.
Do you use tiny little archaeological brushes?
For some of our content, we do. This one was more like a shake out the pages and get the dust off of them. And then, you know, that was just a portion of the material. Some of the materials were absolutely fine. Depending on how the collection was organized originally by the creator and what kind of condition they're in when we receive them, sometimes we will put them in acid-free folders, refolder them into acid-free folders, or put them in folders if they weren't in folders to begin with, or photos would go into sleeves. The gist of it is that we try to organize materials in a logical way. We don't try to do a lot of resorting or second guessing of what the creator did. Usually the way that they organize material makes sense to their thought process, and retaining that thought process for the researcher who's going to come and work with those materials is important. So we call it original order. That's the term that we use, but we try to maintain original order whenever possible. But we put materials into logical groupings. So maybe all of the correspondence would be considered to be a logical grouping. All of the photographs would be considered to be a logical grouping. And at the end of the day, we write up an overview of who the creator was. So a biography in this case of Doris Milner, when she was born, what she did in her life, what activities she would have felt were important to mention, what organization she was involved in. You know, she was a founding member of the Montana Wilderness Association. That's important to mention. And then we'll write up a overview of what you would find in her papers. For example, her correspondence with legislators at the state and the national level trying to get the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness established, because you, the researcher, would want to know that. And we organize them. Ultimately, we create, you know, a listing of the contents, essentially an inventory or a listing of the contents, so that when you, the researcher, look at our listing either on the internet or when you come into the archives, maybe you don't need to look at 25 boxes. Maybe you can figure out which 5 boxes you really need, or where that one photograph of Doris Milner, you know, in 1960 exists. So we try to get you as close as possible. But, you know, if you're a good researcher with enough time, you might want to check out those other boxes as well, in case there's something really critical that she filed in a different folder, and you know, there might be something really helpful to you there as well.
Have you ever been going through those boxes and just about fell down with excitement at what you found in one?
Yes, and because my job is more of overseeing what the department as a whole, I don't get to do this nearly as often as I used to. And it's one of the most fun parts of the job, of course, is actually touching the stuff, that and doing the work with the researchers as they're touching the stuff. But we've had just some absolutely amazing collections. And so recently I was helping a person do research who didn't live here. So I was actually digging into the collection on that person's behalf and came across a handwritten note, something that Mike Mansfield had written to himself, just a sort of a note to file about his thought process around a particular activity and seeing, you know, why do we do it this way? Why does it have to happen this way? And then that was a collection that was already organized, but the fall over, the amazing sort of touching something from the 1960s related to his thought process around the Vietnam War. And there it was, not some memo that somebody had typed up on his behalf for submission to the president or something like that. These were his raw notes, and it was so powerful to touch them. But yeah, certainly I've been organizing collections and been the first person other than the creator or since the creator to put my hands on a photograph of, you know, of their family or something that you knew. Maybe it's the Valentine that their husband sent them that was wrapped up in this special box, and like, it's just powerful. It's just this connection to that person that maybe you never even knew, and yet suddenly you've got this really intimate piece of themselves in your hands. It's It's a great job. And then you share it because you do this so that you can not be the only person who ever holds that, but because you want everybody to be able to know that that exists and to come in and hold it if they want to, or see it online if they don't want to come in.
My heart beats a little faster listening to you talk about that. I can just feel the moment. Have you ever come across something that has changed what is commonly believed or held about some subject?
I don't know that I personally have done that. I absolutely believe that the reason to collect archives, to acquire and preserve and provide access to these primary source materials, whether they're unpublished like diaries or letters or photographed or published, is to provide insight into time period, into people, into thought processes. And I know, I mean, you hear stories of lives being changed, of innocence being proven, of land ownership being documented through these archival materials. And I know, I mean, just the theses and the dissertations that have been written out of the archives, people discover new information all the time, or they are able to reinterpret what was thought to be true because they came in and looked a little deeper, dug a little deeper, explored a little harder, or put the pieces together in a different way, or reinterpreted from a perspective that we care about today. I think diversity is a classic example of that. Women's history, certainly, when, you know, in the 1960s and 70s, when people were starting to look at where were women in the archives and what were women doing, and we learned so much more about women's lives because we went back and re-examined the content of archives, the diaries that were in the archives, the experiences that the women were having that were there available to be researched because an archive had preserved them.
I have to say personally that I love that you're speaking of it that way. For me, the interesting things are usually the diary and the Valentine more than the political document that gets sent, mm-hmm. because it tells you something about who the person was and what was motivating them and how this relationship that they had with this other person really impacted this huge world event.
Right.
I love that stuff.
I'll tell you another story. We had a couple years ago, a student that came in and decided to do his research on when they put the nuclear missile silos in Montana. So he was able to get information about that just by reading the newspaper. But by using Mike Mansfield's papers and the constituent correspondence, he was able to read about what Montanans believed passionately on one side or the other about why we would or would not want to put these silos in the state. So it really gave that personal perspective that reflected the time period, the Cold War, what was happening in Montana, what was needed in the economy, the fears that people had about the safety of their families. So you mentioned the political papers maybe being not quite so powerful, but there is some amazingly powerful content in those political papers.
Yeah, agreed. I don't mean to.
No,
I'm not trying to shame the political papers. I sound like that.
That said, I love the photographs of the families and, you know, the kids in the little, you know, carriage with their dog or their cat. Yeah.
And the letters to grandma. And
Yeah, I really do.
I like the political stuff too. I like putting it all together. I like knowing the 40-dimensional story versus just the what's in the paper.
One of the things that is absolutely I love about my job, the most amazing things about my job, is that you learn something new every single day. So you might learn it because you were digging into a collection, or you might learn it because a researcher came and asked you a question and they're doing research that you'd never, they're asking a question that you'd never thought to ask of the content in your archives before. So every day is something new. And I will also mention that part of my job being a faculty member on campus is to do my own research and also to serve on committees. And the opportunity to interact with colleagues both within the library and on the university campus and then regionally and nationally and learn what they're doing and build the profession together is amazingly rewarding.
I'm really really curious about your analysis of the balance between curiosity and discipline.
Yeah, that is really, really tough, because ideally we would collect everything and we would organize everything for access, and it would be accessible either now or we, you know, if it needed a restriction 30 or 50 years from now. But you really do have to be disciplined, as you said, about what we collect. And that collecting scope helps us. It helps us say no when somebody offers us a collection that either will take way too many resources, it wouldn't be right for us to take it in, or it does not fit well enough with our scope. And an easy example is if somebody offered me a collection about the history of Bozeman or organizations in Bozeman, I could very easily refer that person to the archive at Montana State University and suggest that they contact them as well. And I have made referrals, of course, to the Montana Historical Society for maybe really early pioneer activities that don't specifically relate to Western Montana, because they have a great collection up there as well. If it's about Butte, I always refer to the Butte Silver Bow Archive, because it's such a great facility and they have such great staff. But boy, I wish I could collect it all, because I think at some point there would be a student, an undergraduate student, or somebody writing a thesis or a dissertation who would use that as a topic.
Has there ever been a situation where somebody contacts you about something that they think is so interesting? You know, my great uncle collected every restaurant receipt he ever had, and you need this. Mm-hmm. And you think, I'm not sure that I do. What happens? What does that look like?
That actually happens fairly frequently, and I rely on our collecting scope and the fact that we do collect to support research and scholarship. Recently, I was offered a collection of materials that really did more to document activities that were happening in China in the 1980s. And so although the person who did the collecting had an affiliation with the university, the topic itself was so far out of our scope that I declined it. And I have found that people are very understanding. I mean, they know that you don't have unlimited resources, and they recognize that you have a collecting scope. And when I'm able to refer them someplace else, I certainly always do that, because somebody may be very interested in that content. There are certainly times when content does not appear to have a large amount of research value, and the restaurant receipts are a good example of that. However, things that I have thought might not have a lot of value, and an example of this is a list of laundry that a woman took in when she was doing, you know, work in the 1920s and 1930s during the Depression. When I first looked at it, I thought, gosh, who would use this for research? But it was a small ledger, and I kept it. It turns out it has really interesting implications for research in women's history and in the history of how women supported themselves. And the ledger itself was just on exhibit up at the Historical Society in Helena. So, making those decisions and weighing those decisions is a really important part of the work that we do.
That's such a great example, too, of how the mind of the archivist, you have to think of so many aspects of how it's going to be used and what's useful and what's interesting and what's it going to be like in 100 years. It's overwhelming to me. I'm not sure how you do it.
One of the challenges that we face is being able to maintain the physical materials or the materials regardless of the format. So one of our biggest challenges right now is we have really great collections of audio material, but they're on cassette tapes, which are degrading by their nature. Our acetate negatives, a lot of our photos are on acetate negatives, and we're scanning them, but, you know, we maybe have 50,000 or more acetate negatives, and, you know, one person who's trying to get them all scanned. So the preservation of content is a real challenge for archives, well, cultural heritage repositories in general, both here and abroad, making sure that the environment is stable. We recently, well, not recently, in 2011, hired a digital archivist whose primary focus is on managing the preservation of digital materials, both those that we've digitized and especially things that were never anything but electronic, so that we have access to those as formats change, as we go from WordStar to Word or, you know, version 1 to version 6. We want to still be able to open those files and to be able to guarantee their authenticity, that they are opening in a way that makes them look and act and have the same content that they had when they were created. So
I can imagine there's entire university departments devoted to figuring out those questions. Mm-hmm. That's really, it's again, overwhelming. I'm imagining all the implications of especially making sure that electronic information is valid or
right. Hasn't been changed, hasn't been altered either intentionally or unintentionally, so that you can trust. When you come into my archive and you open up a diary that was written in 1865, the things that tell you that it's authentic are the physical ledger that it's in, the handwriting maybe, or the events that are being talked about, and the fact that maybe, and one thing that's really important to us as archivists is what we call chain of custody or authenticity, the provenance of the item. Who was the creator? How did that piece get from the creator to the archive? And we can document all that, then we can think that that diary that we're holding in our hand is really a Civil War diary or something like that. You need to be able to do the same thing with your electronic material. So having an expert like we do who's helping us work through those issues so that when you come 50 years from now and you open maybe a poem that Patricia Gedeke created on her hard drive, you know, on her computer and saved on her hard drive, you can trust that it sure, that those are the words that Patricia used when she wrote that poem.
How do you do that?
Well, I don't personally do it. So it's, but our digital archivist, Sam Meister, uses a combination of hardware and software and best practices and checksums to sort of, you know, this is what it looked like when it came in. And the checksum says that there has been no disintegration or deterioration of the file over the last year, and multiple copies keep stuff safe, you know. So we have a copy, but there's, you know, multiple other copies. So if one copy goes bad, you can pull the content from another place. There are ways, but it's not easy and it's not cheap.
If you had a year sabbatical and could research anything you wanted, what would you do?
Oh my gosh. It's not that I don't think about this frequently. It's just that it changes. So part of me would love to research some aspect of Montana history. And for me, I would love to dig a little deeper into Mike Mansfield's impact on the state, because his impact on the nation and especially his foreign policy perspective has been researched. But so that's one. But then I think, you know, I would really like to do research in the field of archives and thinking about especially effective teaching of undergraduates, primarily using archival material. How can we be better advocates? How can archives and archivists be better advocates for what we do, for the content that we are responsible for? How do we make the connection with students so that they know these resources are here? And how do we make the connections with community so that they understand how valuable an archive is, whether it's a public, you know, like here at the University of Montana, or whether it's the Historical Society, or whether it's, a community organization documenting and maintaining their own history. So I can't figure out what I would do sabbatical, which is why I haven't taken one yet, because there's so many things that I would, so many directions that I could go.
Are you eligible for one?
I am, yeah.
So you just have to come up with the idea.
Yeah, and then I have to decide in my own heart that it's more important for me to be doing my own research than it is for me to be doing what I consider to be a mission, essentially, which is helping to provide access to the content that we already have and continuing to acquire content. One of the big projects that I've been working on over the last 6 months or so is trying to convince, with a lot of help from colleagues on campus and other places, I'm trying to convince Max Baucus that he should give the University of Montana his papers, because that's 40 years worth of our state's history. I think it belongs here. So not to say that somebody else couldn't do that, but if I was on sabbatical, but it's something that I believe passionately in, that acquiring good materials and making them available. So you had asked the question about what have I found that's particularly appealing to me personally. And the honest answer is, and I know I should be prepared for this because I get this question all the time, what's your favorite thing? And they tell archivists you should have a standard answer for that. But the truth is that I don't have a standard answer yet because I like everything that I have found almost equally. And it really depends on, one day I could love the ledger of communicable diseases that documents who in Missoula County had influenza in 1918. And then in the same day, I can open up that Civil War diary and think, oh my gosh, this is so amazing that somebody documented their experiences and why they wanted to enter the Civil War and why that was important to them. So I do not have a favorite piece or something that I feel personally connected to more than any other piece in the archive. I love the physicality of our glass plate negatives, and I love the content. I really like some of the pictures of agriculture. Okay, so here's something that I absolutely love. We have a picture in the archive, and it's digitized and available on our website, of two kids sitting on a cow at the Missoula County Fair. So a person who looks like their father is holding on to the cow, and then these two kids are sitting on its back. I love that picture. Oh, and we also have a picture of two men who are clearly railroad workers because they're standing in front of an engine. I don't know who those people are. I don't know who the kids were on the cow. I love that. It's Missoula. It's who we are. It's our history. And something about the people just really, even though I don't know who they are, they're not my family. Maybe I'll hang them on my wall anyway and pretend they're my family.
How much time do you feel like you spend finding things like that?
Yeah, unfortunately, or fortunately, because I do really like, being in charge of the department, but unfortunately it means that other people are doing, they are the ones that are finding the stuff, and then they bring it to my attention. Or our Facebook page, I'd love to mention that and give it a pitch. We've got what I think is an amazing Facebook page, and Carly McGill, who's an archive specialist here, puts that together and posts new content every 2 or 3 days. And so if you want to know what we have in the archive that's cool, you should check out our Facebook page, because there is some things that you would never imagine are in the archives, and then just really great photos or pieces of letters or documents, poignant, some funny. She's taken us on road trips with postcards, so there's a lot of really good stuff on there. But I feel like Carly and Kellen and the other people, Mark, who is our photo specialist, they're the ones who get to do all the really fun discoveries, and then they just share it with me.
How many people work for you?
I have, within Archives and Special Collections, there are 5 of us right now, and I am really hoping that I'll be able to hire an oral historian, kind of waiting to see what the university's budget is, but that would be the next place I'd like to go, is really to beef up our oral history collection.
I think about information that is 100 years old, and I find it endlessly fascinating.
Yeah.
I can imagine them just wanting to dig in and asking those questions.
Well, and looking at what society is like. I mean, the centennial of women's suffrage this year has us thinking a lot about what life was like in 1914, not just for women, but for everyone, coming into World War I, so many international events as well as national events and local events. And we're reading the newspaper right now, what was happening in 1914, and thinking then in, 2114, looking back on what was happening in 2014, yeah, and what people will think about our time period and what artifacts we have left behind that represent who we are and what we're doing and how those artifacts will be interpreted 100 years from now is fascinating to think about.
So the centennial is, you and I met at a meeting discussing activities around this 100-year anniversary. Is there anything else that you want to talk about?
I would love the opportunity to just remind everybody that March is Women's History Month. And this year, because of the centennial, we have really put together a number of activities on campus. There's activities happening all over the state. And there's a really great website right now called Women's History Matters that the Montana Historical Society put together that has a lot of really great content about women's history. But at the University of Montana, some things that I will take this opportunity to plug is that Archives and Special Collections created an online exhibit called Women in Montana Politics that's easy to find, and it has a timeline with images and a lot of primary source content just documenting what has happened in Montana politics specifically related to women over the last 100 or 120 years. We will be having here at the Mansfield Library on March 12th, Diane Sands will be giving a talk on a political history of women in Montana, and I'm so excited to hear this talk. Diane Sands has been a really good supporter of Archives and Special Collections. We have her papers here that document her activities, you know, an activist, feminist, and also a legislator. So those that's an archival collection that gets used quite a bit, and we're grateful to her for donating her papers, but also really excited about her March 12th talk here. There is a set of an exhibit that is made up of panels that will actually travel around the state throughout the year, and we're going to open that exhibit here at the library on March 26th. The exhibit itself is called Leading the Way, Montana Woman Suffrage and the Struggle for Equal Citizenship. So on March 26th at 1 o'clock, we'll do an official unveiling of that exhibit, which again then will travel around the state. And boy, there's several other events happening. So I would just encourage people to look at the Women and Gender Studies website for the university, because it has a up-to-date list of events, or at the Archives and Special Collections site.
Are there any other facts or any other pieces of information people might need about the archives? For example, how can they use them, and how can they contact you?
Thank you for that. So I will say the archives, I think the most important thing for people to know is that the archives is open to every single person everywhere. It is we're a public institution, and this is a public archive, and we want people to come and use our content. That said, our current hours are 9 to 5 Monday through Friday. We stay open until 7 on Wednesdays, and we are also available by appointment. So if those hours don't work for people, they can contact me, and I'll make arrangements to meet them early or stay late or come in on a weekend if that's what works for them. We have a website which has a lot of information about the archives, Archives and Special Collections. We have, as I mentioned, both unpublished materials like diaries and letters and political papers, and published materials. So we haven't talked about this, but the oldest book in the library is a 1561 edition of Chaucer. People should come in and see that, touch the paper from 1561, take a look at the other books that we have. That are the rare and unique books in the library, as well as the unpublished content that exists in the archives.
The next time you get an invitation to go to a barn somewhere in the middle of nowhere, can I go?
Yes, you can.
Yeah. It's on the radio. It has
to
happen.
Yeah. No, I'm not sure what the next one will be. I hope it's a trip to Washington, D.C. to get Max Baucus's papers, but
I'll do that too.
I would love to. I mean, there's so much content that, hopefully maybe somebody will hear this and they'll have, not in a barn, but in their attic or anywhere, scrapbooks are fabulous. Scrapbook or letters or, you know, pamphlets that were created, flyers that they produced, a poster of an event that they held. Yeah.
I can imagine going through a box like that in the middle of the night in some, you know, remote area in Western Montana. You said it's going to happen.
It's going to happen. Photo albums. Absolutely. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Anne. I really appreciate this. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
You've been listening to In Other Words on Montana Public Radio. Thanks to Donna McRae for the interview. Music you heard tonight was by Khaki King and by Blue Dream. If you'd like to hear this episode again or catch any of our previous episodes, please go to our website, inotherwordsradio.com. For In Other Words, I'm Anzalda Petrie. Good night.